Hi, Henry Reinga again with Dr. Roy Clauser. I remember when I took philosophy and the next section was epistemology. First of all, I thought, epistemology, that's the strangest word I've ever heard. So what is epistemology?
It is strange, but it comes from the Greek word episteme, which means knowledge.
Okay, knowledge, to yes. Know. Like knowing, what does it mean to know?
Well, the way Plato set this up in a famous dialogue called the Theaetetus, he sets it up so that the question being asked is, under what conditions are we entitled to say we're sure of something, rather than that it's merely opinion?
Okay.
So it may be my opinion that this coming summer is going to be unusually hot, but
right.
I don't really claim to know that for sure.
Right.
But there are other things we do think we know for sure.
One
make two.
Right.
Or things equal to the same thing or equal
so
to each
other.
So not
every knowing is of the same nature of knowing.
No, that's right. How do we distinguish the things we're really sure of? What are we entitled to be sure of? And that's the way he set that up, and that's been very influential ever since. And so in epistemology, when they say we want to account for knowledge, the question is, what can we know for sure, and what makes it sure?
Mm-hmm. And this really becomes a huge question throughout the history of philosophy.
Yeah. Some of the early answers that given by the ancient Greeks were that the only things we could be sure of were logic and mathematics. So that's it.
Everything else is...
Sense perception we know is sometimes unreliable. And then when you come to the modern era, Descartes poses the problem, how can we be sure we're not dreaming?
Right.
How do we tell whether we're awake or asleep? And he comes to the strange conclusion, in my view, that we can't. We can't tell whether we're... Actually, that's nonsense. But,
right.
But, okay, that's the way this stuff gets posed. And again, he's still working with what can we be sure of. And it's not sense perception.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the thing everybody, all day, every day, takes as sure.
Yeah.
Is there any traffic coming? No. How do you know? I looked up the street, there's nothing coming.
Right, that's how
we know. So the fact that every once in a while we can be fooled by a sense perception is a different question.
Mm-hmm.
It's not whether normal sense perception ever yields knowledge, it seems to me,
mm-hmm.
but whether it's infallible.
Right.
No, it's not infallible.
Right.
That's not the same thing.
Right.
So I think it's a big mistake to rule out normal sense perception. That's the best example of knowledge.
But many philosophers have.
Oh, they have. In that tradition that they called rationalism.
Right.
Where they're biased toward the laws of rationality, the mathematical and logical laws.
They're biased toward them, mean that's all you can know.
That's all you can know for sure, logically. Yeah.
Or
so okay, for right. Aristotle, principles of logic and mathematics and a few metaphysical axioms are the only things that can be self-evident.
So like something like God, it cannot be known in their minds.
But a lot of them made those things divine. So they're self-evident. Truths
to them.
To them, that those were the divine principles because they were changeless and nothing could alter them, and they ruled everything else.
So if I know the Creator in my heart and relate to the Creator, there's my self-evident knowledge. It's a faith-based knowledge. I cannot prove it. I just know it.
But nobody can prove any self-evident truth. That's the point.
I see.
The law of non-contradiction can't be proven. You have to use it to prove anything. So, I think the New Testament writers actually speak of faith, of belief in God, that God is real, as a self-evident truth. In Ephesians 1, Paul says to the Christians there at the church at Ephesus, in the times past, you were without God and without hope, and you didn't know the truth. And now you see the truth with the eyes of your heart.
Okay.
And those visual metaphors have long been used for self-evident truth. So you just see it. You see that one and one is two. Well, you don't with your eyes, but with your mind.
Right.
And that's the way he phrased that.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So if you think about self-evident truth and epistemology, is epistemology first, or is knowledge first, or is self-evidency first?
Well, if I'm right about self-evidence, and it's just seeing that something is prima facie true, and right. having that belief just produced in you by
okay.
your experience.
Okay.
Okay. A quick example. I may want it to be a nice day tomorrow, and I get up mm-hmm. and I pull the curtains out, and it's pouring rain.
Right.
I don't choose what to believe, right?
Right.
I see it's pouring rain. It's prima facie true. It produces in me the belief it's raining. It's not going to be the day you hoped for.
Right.
Okay. That if that's right, and the restrictions put on it in the history of philosophy are not,
okay.
then what we do is say we experience things to be self-evidently true all the time. Everybody does it all day, every day. That there's a chair over here and a lamp over here, that there's a road there, that there's a bus coming, don't step out, and so on. Normal sense perception is the classic example of self-evident truth. Then the axioms of math and logic, I'm not dismissing. Yes, they appear to be, we know them because they're self-evident. But that's not the only thing, there are other things. Memory beliefs are self-evident to
right.
us. I know my name and address and telephone number. If you side with the rationalists and say it's only the principles of logic and mathematics that can be done,
right.
then you don't really know your name, address, and telephone number.
Right,
it's a pretty weird thing to say.
Yeah.
Sure, I do. And I know other facts about myself by introspection.
Right.
I have a slight ache in my right toe or something.
Right.
It's
so what you're saying is that there's lots of streams
yes,
of knowledge
exactly.
that come through
exactly.
it. I liked the concept that I remember from your Christian philosophy class that I hope many of you eventually get to take. It's this kind of like, okay, so in God, we can sort of see like, okay, so it's daytime. But well, how do I know it's day? Well, the sun's out. Well, how do I know that it's really day? Well, the sun is warm. Okay. Well, the sun gives me a sunburn. So ultimately, it's not just day. It's irresistibly day.
Yes. So,
yeah.
Oh. A great many of the. I don't know if it's all. I don't know if I can say that. But of great many, the vast majority of our self-evident beliefs are also initially irresistible.
Right.
Just that's what I meant by saying I see the rain and it just produces
yeah.
in me the belief it's raining.
Okay, I go outside, it's wet, it gets more
yes,
wet,
sure.
it gets more wet.
Sure.
It's irresistibly
yes,
raining.
Yes, that's right. It is possible after accepting a truth because it's self-evident to come to doubt it. That's not incompatible.
Right.
The fact is, for a long time, skeptics have argued there is no genuine knowledge.
Right.
There's nothing we can be sure of, because whatever can be doubted can't be certain.
Right.
To my mind, this is a gross mistake. It's a category mistake.
Right.
The fact that I can doubt something says nothing about it, whether it is really doubtful. I can make a mistake about anything.
Right. In fact, doubting is a good test that we should have in our lives in general.
And
I should doubt whether I see correctly the car is not coming.
Okay.
That's good called defensive driving.
Yes.
And
that's right.
Again.
And so I check again.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And Calvin's the one who noticed this. I'm impressed by him. He says, we hold things for certain and doubt them at the same time.
Right.
They're not mutually incompatible. The opposite of knowing for certain is disbelief, not
right.
doubt. Complete real disbelief, rejection
right,
of
right,
it.
Right, right.
That's incompatible. So it's not doubt. And he says the life of the believer is a constant struggle with doubt.
Right.
We are never so well off in the development of our faith that we are immune from doubt. That's what he says.
So think of the implications of the ministry, everybody. You face lives, things happen, the problem of evil comes in there. You're proclaiming Christ. And I know it's true for myself. Like, I could be preaching on a Sunday, and then something happens, the death of a child or one of my parishioners, and then all of a sudden it's as if I'm checking, like, is this real? Is this, you know, all those thoughts come into your mind. So instead of like all of a sudden asking yourself, oh, I must not be a believer, it's more like saying, hey, I am constantly checking, and then the mercies of God come to me, they're fresh every morning. Then I see there's purposes. I see there's things. And then again, it's check. I have doubts, but I also see the faithfulness of God. I experience the faithfulness of God.
That's right.
You know, there's a moment when God is working in a way that's so obvious. So instead of becoming the cynic, even, you know, God's irresistibly presence is even there in difficult times, which is what he promises.
That's right. That's right.
Well, he's not promising the perfections that if something bad happens. No. There, you know, again, that is such a common understanding. We're talking about knowledge here. See, notice how philosophy, you know, the problem of evil is the problem of God. But in the end, it comes down to our thinking, too.
Sure. So our belief. That's right.
So like Descartes had a famous phrase, I think, therefore I am.
Yeah, he too set up epistemology as the quest for certainty. What are we entitled to be certain of? And he too dismisses sense perception.
Okay.
Because he says we can't be sure whether we're awake or asleep. I think that's not true.
Okay.
And he gives us the proof of that sometimes we have realistic dreams.
Right.
And I've had them. I've had maybe three in my life where I really thought it wasn't a dream. I thought it was really happening.
Yeah.
And then I woke up. Okay. But that doesn't show that when we're awake, we don't know we're awake. It means that when we're asleep, we're not. We can't be sure we're asleep. What he needs is the other way around, and he doesn't have it. So he set it up the same way. And then he came up with the only thing he could be sure of was himself.
Right.
That he was aware of things. That's what he means by I think. If I think, I must exist in order to think.
So that I'm a thinking person, a thinking thing.
That's what he says.
Because I'm a thinking thing, I exist.
Right, because you'd have to exist in order to do the act of thinking.
Is that where that whole, if a tree falls in the forest and nobody, you know. Where does that come from?
No, that's different. That's a play on the word here.
Oh, okay.
Okay. If a tree falls in the forest, does it make a noise? A play on the word noise or to hear. In one sense, it doesn't make a noise if it's not heard. That's a heard noise.
Right.
Well, it doesn't make that. But does it make the usual fuss in reality with the airwaves that would be noise if someone were there to hear it? Yes, of course. So it just is a clever way of equivocating on a term there.
So in the world of the theory of knowledge, this is epistemology you're beginning to study, there are those who say all we really can do is just name things. So they're not even real. We attribute something, we give something a name.
Oh, yeah.
Nominalism. You know, so how does nominalism see epistemology, the theory of knowledge?
People had trouble with the realistic theory of universals, so they fled to nominalism. But nobody can be a complete nominalist.
Really?
It's not possible. We see things not only as entities that we perceive, but as kinds of things.
Okay.
This kind of thing is a chair. This kind of thing is a rock. This is a flower. And for that to be so, they have to have a certain combination of properties.
Right.
Right. And nominalism is saying, no, we just divide reality up any way we feel like it.
So we might call this a table, but I might call it a table. You might call it something else.
But it doesn't matter what I call it if I have the same concept of it. So
okay.
You can call it toffle.
Okay.
Mesa.
Right.
Table. Doesn't matter the word we use. What concept does it signify? Well, it's the same concept, or we couldn't talk to each other. We couldn't communicate.
So that shows that nominalism.
Yeah. Is the light red? Okay. I've got to know if it's red or green. Yeah.
Now, I know postmodernism, sort of in many places, which we're going to learn in philosophy along the way, there's modernism. Now, modernism basically on epistemology says what?
Well, the modern period in philosophy was 1600 to 1800. That's Descartes to Kant.
Right.
And that's in the Enlightenment.
Yes.
All right? what's called postmodern really grows out of pragmatism that originated in the U.S. We can all hang our heads
and shame
that that's our major contribution to philosophy. And in the 21st century, it's come full-blown at the end of the 20th and into the 21st as postmodern, and that is there is no certainty.
Right, of anything.
So the self-evidence is nothing but you being conditioned in a certain way.
Right.
There are no arguments that prove this or that. We hold any belief that we hold because it makes us happier than we'd otherwise be. That's a quote from Richard Rorty.
Right.
And all this stuff, everything is loosey-goosey and it's all up for grabs.
Okay.
It's whatever you want to think is true. And
right.
I think that is the most complete nonsense that ever anybody put
Okay,
through.
So we're in epistemology knowing. So it goes from the Greeks, who basically we can only know logic. Okay. That it's sort of, you know, there's the Christian period, a Middle Evil period,
yes.
where there's sort of synthesis. The perfections in medieval, we can know the perfections, or the perfections are knowable.
They're God.
And they're God. Okay. Then we go into the Enlightenment period, where I am a thinking person, therefore a thinking thing, therefore I can know because I know that I'm thinking.
Okay. Well, I can be sure of that.
I can sure, right. Okay. Yep. So then, you know, in 1801, Immanuel Kant passes away, and now you have this, you know, so the modernism is really saying that the certainty is, you know, Immanuel Kant, he defines certainty. So how does he define certainty?
Okay, well, for Kant, what was certain was whatever the categories of the understanding imposed upon our sense perception. And what the categories impose are logical concept, logical order, and mathematical order, and so on. Space and time are already imposed on them.
Right.
But that would count as knowledge. That would be scientific knowledge.
That's okay.
What can be proven. It comes down on the rational side.
Logic and math. Yeah.
Okay. But Kant also puts forward his notion of ideas of the reason.
Okay.
And this means that any rational being thinking about the world and him or herself and their place in the world is bound to come up with the idea with such ideas as freedom. I'm free to act,
right.
And I'm responsible for what I do. It's bound to come up with the idea there are objects out there that are independent of me.
Okay.
And bound to come up with the idea there's a most real being.
Okay.
There's God. And these ideas of the reason can't be proven.
Okay.
They can't be proven false. They can't be proven true.
Right.
The idea, the categories of the understanding are not applied to them. They're applied to sensations.
Right.
So there's no way to establish the truth of any of these, but they are practical necessities. That people need these in order to get along in life. And that's exactly what pragmatism picks up.
Right.
In effect, it says all our concepts and beliefs are like Kant's ideas of the reason. It picks up that third thing says not of the other.
So even logic,
even
is not.
Logic and science, it's all just so stories we tell ourselves, and they're all in the category of ideas that can't be proven or disproven.
Didn't know where the existentials in that thing. Mick, how did they, their theory
harder.
Of knowledge, epistemology.
Yeah, you don't get a lot of theories of knowledge from existentialists.
They're just pushing back.
Yeah, there are some. They're more concerned with ontology, and they're concerned with the place of the human being in reality.
Okay.
And the rest of reality.
So they're not even dealing with questions of epistemology. They're dealing with questions of ontology and our relationship.
It's closer to ontology. And of course, and they differ so radically, it's hard to characterize them all.
Okay.
So if you talk about, take Jean-Paul Sartre, his concern is about humans and human freedom.
Mm-hmm.
So his position is, this is rather strange, okay?
Right.
When a human being comes into existence, when humans are first born, they are completely free.
Mm-hmm.
And with every decision, with every choice they make, they box themselves into a particular nature or habit of thought
and so on.
And so they are literally self-made. When they're first born, they're nothing. They have no nature.
Right.
They create their own nature. That's the meaning of being and nothingness. Being is determinate. Nothingness is free. So now they make choice after choice after choice, and they become less and less and less free and more determined as to what they'll do in the next. So he says we're doomed to be free. It's a curse.
Okay.
And we can't get rid of it, but there it is. So, and as far as the existence of God...
So that would be an ontology question, because it's really the person in relationship...
About the ontology of a human being.
Yes, then, a human being.
Heidegger has another view, of course, not that humans determine their own nature, but that they're just thrown into the world. They find themselves surrounded by all this mess that it's hard to make any sense of, and so on. So you get very different. The thinker Jaspers was a lot closer to Christian belief. It's a lot easier to see that.
Kierkegaard.
Kierkegaard was a Christian.
Yes.
He's often called the first existentialist, but not because he did this kind of crazy stuff. What he was really after affirming was that there are humans, and they are responsible before God, and we do have freedom. And he wanted to assert all that against Hegelian philosophy. He's a progenitor of going in a different direction, but he's not really in the class for the rest of it.
So to wrap up the epistemology discussion, let's go back to Dooyeweerd, Christian philosopher Herman Dooyeweerd, that Dr. Clauser studied. He was actually the last living person as of 2019 who studied with him. And it was fascinating. How would he look at epistemology?
Dooyeweerd developed an ontology, and he never developed a corresponding epistemology.
Okay, so in your opinion...
He did write a section in which he said that here are the prospects for how epistemology ought to go if this ontology is correct. And it seems to me that the epistemology that I propose in this third book is in accord with that.
Okay, and so briefly, how does it go?
Certainly doesn't violate it. Well, I think a great many more of our beliefs are self-evident than has been given credit for in the tradition. All the way back in Plato and Aristotle's time, they allowed self-evident beliefs to count as knowledge, but they put three restrictions on them.
Okay.
They said to be a really genuine self-evident belief, it can't just be that it's prima facie true and irresistible. And so it has to be accepted by everybody.
Okay. Everybody.
No, Aristotle says... all the experts in the field in which the belief arises.
Okay.
Descartes says anyone who is in the least degree rational.
Okay.
So he democratizes it to everybody.
Yeah.
Number two, it has to be a law.
Okay.
Only laws can be self-evident.
Okay.
Necessary truths. That's
right.
The way Aristotle puts it.
Right.
So, in other words, that there's a chair over there, or that I know my name, address, and telephone number. No, those aren't laws. I don't know them.
Right.
And third, if all the experts or everybody does agree and it's a law and it's self-evident, it's infallible. Can't be wrong.
Oh, infallible.
Infallible.
Okay.
So they put those restrictions on. Now, when it comes down to, the 20th and the 21st century, our time.
Yeah.
It's the being self-evident to everyone that they take to be the hallmark of a self-evident truth.
Oh.
They pick that one, that becomes
democracy.
The way it's talked about is, well, if it's obvious to everybody...
The 51% agree or study...
See, that's the weird thing.
Politics epistemology.
How then would you ever tell, for any truth whatsoever, that everybody agreed it was self-evident?
Yeah, you did.
Because everybody doesn't mean all the people alive
now.
It means all the people that ever did live and all the people that ever will. So how are you going to canvass the dead and the unborn? There's no way to find out whether everybody regards this. Or even all the experts. Again, how about the dead experts and the unborn experts? There's no way to check this at all. So are you going to say that this restriction is itself self-evident? Well, it's not to me.
No.
And therefore, it's not.
Oh, there's the logical fallacy.
You see?
So you would believe in that Christian philosophy world, by not creating an idol even out of the democratization of certainty. So, in a sense, that's what this would be. It would be, the idol would be democracy of certainty.
Yeah, and things are if something is self-evident to a person, And it passes the checks.
Right.
Now, that's another thing that I've tried to bring up that I don't find emphasized by anyone else.
Right.
When we do experience something as self-evident, that's not the end of it. We check on it.
Right.
So we've already given the example of looking up the street and there's nothing coming.
Yeah, yeah.
But I look again to make sure. And for memory beliefs, I check against photographs or written records. Somebody else, how do you remember that?
Right.
We don't check with other people on our internal states,
with
introspection, but we do on memories and so on. And even the so-called rational truths, laws of logic and mathematics, those we check by seeing if they're consistent with one another, form a consistent set, if the axioms are consistent. But there are a lot more truths that we know intuitively, like we know in the same manner in which we know rational truths that aren't just rational truths. So I don't like calling them that.
Right.
For example, everybody who's born acquires instantly the belief that other people have minds.
Right.
It's not because they see the other person's mind.
Right.
But that it's in our experience, it becomes self-evident.
Right.
Everybody who born, no matter where they are, they all believe that they act freely, at least at times.
Right.
That they're responsible for their choices.
Yeah.
That when other people do rotten things, that was really rotten. They've experienced that. There are moral truths that are independent of themselves. So all that stuff, I think, is self-evident if it's properly defined. The restrictions are nonsense.
So,
I'm using a polite word.
I get
the restrictions. Yeah, I take in the new book. I take each of the restrictions and show that they're self-defeating, unjustified, and inconsistent with one another.
So really, then, you know, you think of God's word is His revealed word in creation, the laws, and we know spiritually a word from the Word of God, the Bible. We have been given the gifts of the history of the experience of other humans,
which
is a lot of philosophy. You
That's
know,
right.
In the fact that I know that you have a brain right here, and that I self-evidently acknowledge that, and I have one in me, and you know, that's that Descartes thinker thing that we all you know.
When we could cut each other's heads open and see the brain, we can't see the mind.
Right.
But we believe other people have minds. Everybody believes it naturally. That's a self-evident belief that arises.
Yeah. So here you are. You're in epistemology. Enjoy it. We've raised some questions. Remember what Dr. Clauser has said in previous session, that raising the questions is a lot of it. And as you study it, study for yourself and see how you can see the nature of creation and see how the beauty of God's revelation. So anyway, till next time, we'll talk to you later.